In the morning, Sipu was full of high spirits again, almost as though their conversation in the night had never taken place. Kelly gave him the present which she had brought for him, a Swiss army knife. Sipu was enchanted with all the blades and implements and tools that folded out of the red plastic handle, and promptly cut himself on one of them. He cackled with laughter and sucked his thumb, then held it out to Kelly as proof of the marvellous sharpness of the little blade. Kelly knew he would probably lose the knife within a week, or give it away to someone else in the tribe on an impulse, as he had done with all the other gifts she had given him, but for the moment his joy was childlike and complete. "Now you must show me the bleeding rivers," she reminded him, as she adjusted the headband of her pack, and for a moment his eyes were sad again. Then he grinned and pirouetted. "Come along, Karakai. Let us see if you still move in the forest like one of the real people." Soon they left the broad trail, and Sepu led her swiftly through the secret unmarked ways. He danced ahead of her like a sprite, and the foliage closed behind him, leaving no trace of his passing. Where Sepu moved upright, Kelly was forced to stoop beneath the branches, and at times she lost sight of him. No wonder the old Egyptians believed the bambuti had the power of invisibility, Kelly thought, as she extended herself to keep up with him. If Sepu had moved silently, she might have lost him, but like all the pygmies, he sang and laughed and chatted to her and the forest as he went. His voice ahead guided her and warned the dangerous forest creatures of his approach so that there would be no confrontation. She knew that he was moving at his best pace to test and tease her, and she was determined not to fall too far behind. She called replies back to him and joined in the chorus of the praise songs, and when he stepped out on the bank of the river, many hours later, she was only seconds behind him. He grinned at her until his eyes disappeared in the web of wrinkles and shook his head in reluctant approval. But Kelly was not interested in his approbation. She was gazing at the river. This was one of the tributaries of the Yubomo that had its source high up in the mountains of the moon, at the foot of one of the glaciers above 15,000 feet, the altitude where the permanent snow line stood. The river found its way down through lakes and waterfalls, fed by the mighty rains that lashed this wettest of all mountain ranges, down through the treeless moors and heather, down through the forest of giant prehistoric ferns, until at last it entered the dense bamboo thickets, which were the domain of gorilla and spiral-horned bongo antelope. From there it fell again another 3,000 feet through rugged foothills, until it reached these true rainforests with their galleried canopies of gigantic hardwoods. The bambuti call this river Tetwa, after the silver catfish that abounded in its sweet clear waters and shoaled on the yellow sandbanks. The bambuti women shed even their tiny loincloths when they went into the waters of the Tetwa to catch the barbled catfish. Each of them armed with a fish basket of woven reeds and bark, they surrounded the shoal and splashed and shrieked with excitement as they flipped the struggling, slippery silver fish from the sparkling water. That had been before the river began to bleed. Now Kelly stared at it in horror. The river was 50 yards wide, and the forest grew right to the edge and formed a canopy that almost but not quite met overhead. There was a narrow, irregular gleam of sky high above the middle of the river course. From bank to bank the river ran red, not the bright red of heart blood, but a darker, browner hue. The sullied waters seemed almost viscous. They had lost their sparkle and were heavy and dull, running thick and slow as used engine oil. The sand spits were red also, coated with a deep layer of thick mud. The carcasses of the catfish were strewn on the red banks, thick as autumn leaves, piled upon each other in their multitudes. Their skulls were eyeless, and the stench of their putrefying flesh was oppressive in the humid air below the forest canopy. "What has done this, Sipu?" Kelly whispered. But he shrugged and busied himself, rolling a pinch of coarse black native tobacco in a leaf. While Kelly went down to the bank, he lit his primitive cheroot from the live coal he carried wrapped in a pouch of green leaves around his neck. He puffed great clouds of blue smoke, squeezing his eyes tightly shut with pleasure. As Kelly stepped out onto the sand pit, he sank almost knee-deep into the mud. She scooped up a handful of it and rubbed it between her fingers. It was slick as grease, fine as potter's clay, and it stained her skin a dark sang de boeuf. She tried to wash it off, but the colour was fast, and her fingers were red as those of an assassin. She lifted a handful of mud to her nose and sniffed it. It had no alien smell. She waded back to the bank and confronted Sipu. "What has done this, old father? What has happened?" He sucked on his cheroot, then coughed and giggled nervously, avoiding her gaze. "Come on, Sipu, tell me." "I do not know, Karakai." "Why not? Did you not go upstream to find out?" Sepu examined the burning end of his green leaf cheroot with great interest. "Why not?" Kelly insisted.
"I was afraid, Karakai," he mumbled.
And Kelly suddenly realized that for the Bambuti this was some supernatural occurrence. They would not follow the choke rivers upstream for fear of what they might find. "How many rivers are like this?" Kelly demanded.
"Many, many," Sipu muttered, meaning more than four.
"Name them for me," she insisted, and he reeled off the names of all the rivers she had ever visited in the region, and some that she had only heard of. It seemed then that almost the entire drainage area of the Ubomo was affected. This was not some isolated local disturbance, but a large-scale disaster that threatened not only the Bambuti hunting areas, but the sacred heartland of the forest as well.
"We must travel upstream," Kelly said with finality, and Sepu looked as though he might burst into tears.
"They are waiting for you at Gondola," he squeaked. But Kelly did not make the mistake of beginning an argument. She had learned from the women of the tribe, from old Pumba in particular. She lifted her pack onto her back, adjusted the headband, and started up the bank. For 200 yards she was alone, and her spirits started to sink. The forest area ahead was completely unknown to her, and it would be folly to continue on her own if Sepu could not be induced to accompany her. Then she heard Sepu's voice close behind her, protesting loudly that he would not take another step further. Kelly grinned with relief and quickened her pace. For another 20 minutes Sepu trailed along behind her, swearing that he was on the point of turning back and abandoning her, his tone becoming more and more plaintive as he realized that Kelly was not going to give in. Then, quite suddenly, he chuckled and began to sing. The effort of remaining miserable was too much for him to sustain. Kelly shouted a jibe over her shoulder and joined in the next refrain of the song. Soon Sepu slipped past her and took the lead. For the next 2 days they followed the Tetwa River, and with every mile its plight was more pitiful. The red clay clogged it more deeply. The waters were almost pure mud, thick as oatmeal porridge, and there were dead roots and loose vegetation mixed into it, already beginning to bubble with the gas of decay. The stink of it mingled with that of dead birds and small animals and rotting fish that had been trapped and suffocated by the mud. The carcasses were strewn upon the red banks or floated with balloon bellies upon the sullied waters. Late in the afternoon of the second day they reached the far boundary of Sepu's tribal hunting grounds. There was no signpost or other indication to mark the line, but Sepu paused on the bank of the Tetwa, unstrung his bow and reversed his arrows in the rolled bark quiver on his shoulder, as a sign to the mother and the father of the forest that he would respect the sacred place and kill no creature, cut no branch, nor light a fire within these deep forest preserves. Then he sang a pygmy song to placate the forest and to ask permission to enter its deep and secret place. "O beloved mother of all the tribe, you gave us first suck at your breast, and cradled us in the darkness. O respected father of our fathers, you made us strong. You taught us the ways of the forest, and gave us your creatures as food. We honour you. We praise you." Kelly stood a little aside and watched him. It seemed presumptuous for her to join in the words, so she was silent. In her book, The People of the Tall Trees, she had examined in detail the tradition of the forest heartland and discussed the wisdom of the Bambuti law. The heartland was the reservoir of forest life, which spilled over into the hunting preserves, renewing and sustaining them. It was also the buffer zone which separated each of the tribes from its neighbours and obviated friction and territorial dispute between them. This was only another example of the wisdom of the system that the Bambuti had evolved to regulate and manage their existence. So Kelly and Sepu camped that night on the threshold of the sacred heartland. During the night it rained, which Sepu proclaimed was a definite sign from the forest deities that they were amenable to the two of them continuing their journey upstream. Kelly smiled in the darkness. It rained on average 300 nights a year in the Ubomo Basin, and if it had not done so tonight, Sepu would probably have taken that as even more eloquent assent from the mother and the father. They resumed the journey at dawn.
when one of the striped forest duiker trotted out of the undergrowth ahead of them and stood to regard them trustingly from a distance of 5 paces, Seppu reached instinctively for his bow and then controlled himself with such an effort that he shook as though he were in a malarial ague. The flesh of this little antelope was tender and succulent and sweet.
"Go!" Seppu yelled at it angrily. "Away with you! Do not mock me! Do not tempt me! I am firm against your wiles!"
The duiker slipped off the path, and Seppu turned to Kelly. "Bear witness for me, Karakai. I did not trespass. That creature was sent by the mother and father to test me. No natural duiker would be so stupid as to stand so close. I was strong, was I not, Karakai?" he demanded piteously, and Kelly squeezed his muscular shoulder. "I am proud of you, old father. The gods love you." They went on. In the middle of the third afternoon, Kelly paused suddenly in mid-stride and cocked her head to a sound she had never heard in the forest before. It was still faint and intermittent, blanketed by the trees. But as she went on, it became clearer and stronger with each mile until it resembled, in Kelly's imagination, the growling of lions on the kill, a terrible, savage and feral sound that filled her with despair. Now the river Tetwa no longer flowed. It was dammed with branches and debris, so that in places it had broken its banks and flooded the forest floor, and they were forced to wade waist-deep through the stinking swamp. Then, abruptly, with a shock of disclosure, the forest ended, and they were standing in sunlight, where sunlight had not penetrated for 1,000,000 years. Ahead of them was such a sight as Kelly could not have conceived in her most hideous nightmares. She gazed upon it until night fell, and mercifully hid it from her. And then she turned away and went back. In the night she came awake to find herself weeping aloud, and Seppu's hand stroking her arm to comfort her. The return journey down the dying river was slower, as though she were burdened by her sadness, and Seppu shortened his stride to match her. 5 days later, Kelly and Seppu reached Gondala.